The following program is not a production of Audio Journal. External programs like this are selected with the interests of our audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed in this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.
It's Scott, and I have a series of stories about diabetes to share. And the first one comes from the German Center for Diabetes Research, and it is headlined, "New Study Debunks the Biggest Fear About Yo-Yo Dieting." Repeated weight loss followed by weight regain, often known as yo-yo dieting or weight cycling, has long been viewed as unhealthy and potentially even worse than being overweight. However, a major new review published in The Lancet Diabetes and Endocrinology argues that this belief is not backed by strong scientific evidence. In an Invited Personal View article, Professor Fadon Magkos of the University of Copenhagen and Professor Norbert Steffen of the German Center for Diabetes Research reviewed decades of research involving both humans and animals. After examining the evidence, they found no convincing proof that weight cycling itself causes long-term harm in people with obesity. Many people struggle with weight, and they are discouraged from trying to lose weight because they fear yo-yo dieting will lead to muscle loss and somehow damage their metabolism, says Professor Magkos. Our review indicates that these fears are largely not supported. In most cases, the benefits of trying to lose weight clearly outweigh the theoretical risks of weight cycling. For years, weight cycling has been linked to a wide range of health concerns, including greater fat accumulation, faster muscle loss, slower metabolism, and increased risks of diabetes and cardiovascular disease. These concerns have influenced public opinion and even medical advice, leading some people to believe that repeated dieting attempts may ultimately cause more harm than benefit. This new analysis, however, disputes that idea. Researchers did review observational studies, randomized clinical trials, and animal studies that were focused on repeated weight loss and regain. They examined how weight cycling affects body weight, body composition, metabolism, and blood sugar control. Once you properly account for pre-existing health conditions, aging, and overall exposure to obesity, Professor Steffen explains that the supposed harmful effects of weight cycling largely disappear. The review found no consistent evidence that weight cycling leads to excessive loss of lean muscle mass or causes lasting metabolic slowdown. In many cases, people who regained weight returned to a body composition similar to where they started, rather than ending up in a worse condition. Researchers also found no strong evidence that weight cycling is responsible for the gradual long-term weight gain commonly seen in obesity. The authors of the study stress that an important distinction exists. Regaining weight can undo many of the positive effects of weight loss, including improvements in blood sugar, blood pressure, and cholesterol levels. But losing those benefits does not necessarily mean a person becomes less healthy than they were before losing the weight. Regaining weight brings people back toward baseline risk and not beyond it, says Professor Magkos. There's a crucial difference between losing benefits and causing harm. Several large studies also show that when researchers account for a person's average body weight over time, weight cycling itself is no longer linked to higher risks of diabetes or cardiovascular disease. Instead, excess body fat appears to be the main factor that drives metabolic risk. The findings come at a time when newer obesity medications, so-called GLP-1 drugs and dual incretin agonists, are becoming increasingly common. These drugs can produce significant weight loss, but many patients do regain weight after stopping treatment, creating a pattern similar to weight cycling. According to the researchers, This regain should not automatically be viewed as harmful. Even temporary periods of weight reduction can still provide important health benefits and improve quality of life, even if the weight loss is not permanent. The researchers say evidence should encourage people with overweight or obesity not to abandon efforts to lose weight simply because maintaining weight loss can be difficult. The idea that yo-yo dieting ruins your metabolism isn't supported by robust evidence, the researchers say. Trying, and even failing, to lose weight is not harmful. Giving up altogether, however, may be. Our next story comes from National Geographic, and it carries a very intriguing headline. A cure for type 1 diabetes is close. When Amanda Smith walked into the kitchen one night in 2015 to warm up a bottle for her four-month-old daughter, she couldn't make out the numbers on the microwave oven. They were blurry. They'd never been blurry. Suddenly, a dark thought entered her mind. Diabetes. Her mom had it, and Smith herself was a nurse. She knew the signs. Her immune system, probably months ago, had begun destroying the cells of her pancreas that produce insulin, a hormone that enables the body to burn sugar. And now, she was so low on insulin that the sugars in her blood were building up, pumping the lenses of her eyes with fluid and distorting the light that entered. She woke her husband, and they raced to the hospital in Ontario, Canada, where a test confirmed her blood sugar was soaring, more than six times healthy levels. Then a doctor injected her with insulin, and her levels crashed. It was hard from the beginning, she says. The diagnosis of type 1 diabetes, a chronic, incurable disease, made her angry. It made her sad. Her blood sugar crashed regularly from insulin injections, making her irritable. She would get short with her husband. She'd get short with her three kids. She felt like she was a burden on everyone around her. No matter how hard she tried, she felt like she had failed over and over to manage her blood sugar. But as of last fall, Smith has not had to take supplemental insulin in more than 2 years. She says it feels like freedom. She is part of the first wave of patients to receive what doctors and scientists are cautiously saying could well be, one day soon, a cure. I never say cure, says Kevin Harold, a physician, immunologist, and type 1 diabetes researcher at Yale University School of Medicine. But, he adds, that's the direction we're headed in. The breakthrough seems well-timed. An estimated 9.5 million people globally have type 1 diabetes, and rates are climbing, particularly among children and young adults. Researchers don't know why. Before her treatment, Amanda Smith, who's now 36 years old, felt imprisoned in her own body, locked up in the minute-by-minute monotony of managing her blood sugar. It sucked all around, she said. Even taking my kid to the park, I had to make sure I had snacks in my pocket in case I got low blood sugar. But now, she says, I get so emotional sometimes about it. Even if the treatment just lasts a couple years, she says, these are the best years. Her treatment is still in experimental clinical trials, results from which were published in June in the New England Journal of Medicine. The drug company running the trials, Vertex Pharmaceuticals, hopes to be able to release the treatment sometime this decade and predicts, pending approval by the Food and Drug Administration and regulators in Europe, a base of some 40 to 60,000 customers in the United States and Europe. The treatment, called VX880, will likely first be prescribed to a subset of type 1 diabetics, like Smith, who can't maintain safe blood sugar levels with insulin therapy, no matter how hard they try. It is not developed as a general therapy, largely because it requires immune suppression drugs, a trade-off that many diabetics will not likely want to make. But what the moment represents, according to scientists, is profound. For more than 100 years, doctors have treated this disease by returning to the body the chemical it could no longer make, that is, insulin. And while the discovery of insulin transformed a fatal disease into one that is treatable, type 1 diabetes is still a disease that requires constant vigilance and management. Now, scientists are learning to restore the very source of insulin secretion to return the missing parts. The medicine continues to evolve. Scientists are working to deliver similar treatments without having to suppress the immune system. If VX-880 continues working, researchers say the underlying science could well end up curing more than just diabetes. In ancient times, physicians noticed that the urine of certain people attracted black ants, and the ants were like an omen. Children wasted away within days of the ants' appearance, and adults with more fat and muscle for their bodies to eat lived a little longer. It was as if these people were liquefying, physicians observed, flushing themselves out in their urine. They urinated constantly, and the ants were drawn to it because it was sticky and sweet like honey. Shortly after the birth of Christ, an ancient Greek physician, Areteus of Cappadocia, dubbed the condition diabetes. The word means siphon, because, seemingly, all the nutrition of food and drink were passing right through people. For reasons doctors still don't understand, the immune system of type 1 diabetics begins, often in youth, spontaneously destroying the body's sole source of insulin production, beta cells, which live within a larger cell type, islet cells, which pack the pancreas. When someone with a fully functioning pancreas eats, say, a banana, sugar from the banana accumulates in the bloodstream. Insulin allows the sugar to enter the cells. This is the primary way humans make energy from food. Without enough healthy beta cells, the pancreas secretes little to no insulin, and sugar builds up in the blood, becoming essentially a poison. High blood sugar damages nerves, blood vessels, tissues, and organs. Cells, meanwhile, starve. Searching for fuel, the body reaches instead for fats, and as it burns them, acid also builds up in the bloodstream. Globally, 1 in 9 adults have diabetes. Most have type 2. People with type 2 often do produce insulin, but their cells don't respond well to the hormone and can't absorb sugar, which builds up. The underlying causes of type 2 diabetes are well understood, involving lifestyle factors mainly, such as eating unhealthy foods or exercising too little. But for type 1 diabetes, they're a mystery. What researchers do know is type 1 is most prevalent among young people in rich countries, where many patients have the money, access, and education to blunt the lethality of the disease. For example, a young boy diagnosed at age 10 in this country is likely to live to 67. But in a place like Afghanistan, that same boy would probably die at age 24. For centuries, the leading treatment for type 1 diabetes was to deprive the body of any nutrients to siphon in the first place, essentially starvation. That was humanity's best treatment until 1921, when a young Canadian surgeon, Frederick Banting, and a medical student, Charles Best, removed the pancreas from a dog. They then crushed the glands of the organ, froze them, ground them up, sucked them into a needle, and shot them back into the dog, which had become diabetic without its pancreas. The dog's blood sugar dropped within 2 hours. It was the first time anyone had isolated insulin, and the following year, a 14-year-old boy dying of diabetes in a Toronto hospital received an injection of insulin extracted from bovine pancreases. His blood sugar dropped within hours, and suddenly, a terminal disease became treatable. That discovery saved tens of millions of lives. In the 100 years since, doctors sometimes like to say that with therapeutic insulin, type 1 diabetics can live a so-called normal life. But their definition of normal is relative, and they tend to place the onus of achieving normalcy squarely on the patient. You Can Stay Healthy, a 1999 publication of the American Academy of Family Physicians, admonishes, if you control your disease. All the challenges of living with type 1 diabetes in the post-insulin world can be boiled down into those two letters, IF, if. If a diabetic is able to control the disease, her life, often outwardly, can look normal. But internally, it's a battle. Every day, she must do the job of the beta cells herself, continuously monitoring her blood sugar with test strips or a glucose monitor. The job involves guesswork and anticipation. What has she eaten? What will she eat? What about exercise? Is she stressed, tired, dehydrated, sick, off her game? Her answers to these little questions help her answer the big one. How much insulin, by needle or wearable pump, does she dose? Dosing too little often can hurt her in the future, but dosing too much can kill her where she stands. On average, a patient makes 180 decisions about their type 1 diabetes every day. Most type 1 diabetics can control the disease. Chris Binder, for example, played Division I football at the University of Maine in the 1990s. He was a kicker. From the stands, no one could tell that he'd been diagnosed at the age of 2, although at halftime, staff always made sure he had a big sandwich in case his blood sugar slumped. They'd say, "Is Binder's grinder here?" He is 50 years old today, lives in New Orleans, and works at a tech company that consults with collegiate and professional sports teams to improve players' performance. There isn't much he can't do. The disease does not dictate his life. He says, "I think I have really lived with diabetes and not lived for diabetes." But if a diabetic is unable to control the disease, life looks very different. While tying her shoes one morning before work, Jennifer Coleman, a 60-year-old accountant in Alberta, Canada, put her head through a glass cabinet as a low blood sugar-induced seizure raced through her. She does not get the warning signs that many diabetics get when their sugar crashes, things like shaky knees, sweaty palms, a foggy mind, and a feeling of doom. So she would frequently get blindsided by the low lows. "It takes so much planning to do anything," she says. "That's the biggest thing. And you have to be prepared for bad things." Dr. Heather McLeod, a 59-year-old family doctor in Vancouver, was diagnosed when she was 6 years old. Even with her medical training, her blood sugar often would range wildly. "If I'm going on a walk," she says, "I better bring 3 juice boxes, and I better have my insulin with me. Do I have enough test strips? Do I have my sensors?" Like Coleman, Dr. McLeod doesn't get typical warnings. "It's just living in fear," she says. "I sometimes feel like Cinderella. I don't know when my coach is going to turn into a pumpkin." The same can be true for Marianne Pokersnick. People just don't understand the emotional toll of something when you work so hard and you still fail, Pokersnick says. Diagnosed at 11, she's now 55 and a retired high school math and science teacher. For many years, she was her daughter's only ride to dance class, but often Pokersnick's blood sugar was too low to drive, and her daughter would bawl her eyes out. People think that with the new technology, better insulin pumps, better monitors and algorithms, that that's an answer, she says. It really is not. Type 1 diabetes exists on a spectrum. Binder might represent the far end of one side, Coleman, McLeod, and Pokersnick the other. But the bottom line is that if anyone slips up, they can die. Because even today's most sophisticated medical devices still can't match the precision of the tiny biological machines that come as stock in the human pancreas, those beta cells. That's why scientists have, for decades now, tried to find a way to replace them. The origins of the Vertex breakthrough date back to a night in 1991, when Doug Melton, a 38-year-old professor of developmental biology at Harvard, was studying the eggs of African clawed frogs in the basement of the biological laboratories. Melton was searching for the genes that tell the early stem cells of a single fertilized egg to transform into specialized cells. Then he got a call from his wife, Gail. Sam, their six-month-old son, was vomiting. He raced out of his lab, and in the emergency room of Boston Children's Hospital, he and Gail would learn their son had type 1 diabetes. After that diagnosis, Melton gathered everyone in his lab, all 25 to 30 of his colleagues, and told them he was transitioning away from their research on frogs. Harvard had agreed to build Melton a new lab so that he could pursue a new mission, a cure for type 1 diabetes. He was not completely starting over. His work with the cells of frog embryos did suggest a way forward. Those early stem cells are like biological blank slates. With the right stimuli, they can turn into any cell in the body. Melton just had to figure out the stimuli to coax human stem cells into functioning beta cells. He was already, as he puts it, a painter, but now, he says, I was told what the subject of the painting was going to be. He told me recently he had no idea how difficult his research would become. He's grateful for that. If he had known, he says, he might have quit. It seemed to me to be a simple idea, he says, engineer the cells that his son had lost, then put them back in, all the while preventing the immune system from destroying the cells. He told his wife it would take him 3 to 4 years. Between 1990 and 1999, Melton raced past that 3 to 4 year deadline and then zipped past it again. He wasn't the only researcher looking into cell therapies, but they were each working in isolation. Back then, the scientific community was more preoccupied with trying to understand the mechanism by which insulin is secreted, not how to make the cells that do the secreting. Then there was a breakthrough that cast their work in a new light. In a clinical trial between 1999 and 2000, Dr. James Shapiro at the University of Alberta transplanted islet cells from cadavers into 7 patients with severe type 1 diabetes. Other doctors had tried similar procedures with marginal success, but Shapiro developed a new protocol. He sourced healthy cells from multiple cadavers, processed them in a novel solution, and suppressed patient immune systems with steroid-free drugs. Steroids tended to backfire in patients, making them insulin resistant and damaging their beta cells. Every patient quickly began producing enough of their own insulin that they no longer needed to inject it, and they continued producing insulin at follow-up more than 1 year later. Pokersnik was Shapiro's second patient in that trial. It was hard for me to even wrap my mind around it, she says, because I'd been diabetic for so long. Later, Dr. Shapiro also performed the procedure on both McLeod and Coleman. The women say the therapy liberated them from the minute-by-minute calculations they often made when managing their disease using pharmaceutical insulin. It also saved them from constant crashes. Coleman says it changed a lot. Really, for me, McLeod says, there was no other option. After the New England Journal of Medicine published the results in 2000, the University of Alberta Hospital switchboard operators were overwhelmed. Patients from all over the world wanted to get on Shapiro's transplant list, and soon he would land a $35 million grant to do more trials. While his protocol became available for patients who could not control their diabetes by other means, it was never broadly prescribed. The cells from cadavers required immunosuppressant drugs, which risk new infections and novel cancers. The cells also originate from a finite resource, deceased people. Patients typically need cells from 2 to 3 donors, and it's not a one-time thing. The cells do sometimes die, necessitating top-ups. Pokersnik, for instance, was off supplemental insulin within weeks of her first transplant in 1999. Then in 2003, she was back on it. In 2014, off again. In 2013, back on. Since 2019, she has been off insulin. Still, says Laurie Sussell, who's the research director at the Barbara Davis Center for Diabetes at the University of Colorado, Dr. Shapiro's work was an inflection point. It was, she said, proof of concept. When scientists saw that the islet cells were surviving in patients, they began to think that maybe Melton and the others were onto something after all. If cells from cadavers restore insulin production in patients, why can't cells grown in a lab? People that weren't interested in stem cell therapy before, Dr. Shapiro says, suddenly got interested. Now, suddenly, Melton and the other researchers who had all been working in isolation began working together, and scientists who hadn't thought much of their work began their own experiments, and funding did follow. 1 year after Dr. Shapiro went public with his results, the National Institutes of Health created the Beta Cell Biology Consortium, which began awarding grants even to researchers in Europe. As the pace of research quickened, one breakthrough seemed to beget another, and Melton began to figure out how to grow the cells. Within each of the trillions of cells in the human body, there are about 20,000 genes, only a quarter to a half of which are expressed. Cells read genes to learn how to do what they need to do. And Melton and his team were puzzling over which genes a stem cell needed to read to learn how to secrete insulin. Which ones do they turn on in a stem cell, the scientists wondered, and which ones do they turn off? This, Melton says, half-joking, is an excuse for why it took us so long. One night in 2012, his colleagues were huddled in the lab around a sheet of plastic that looked like an enormous egg carton. It contained 96 small trays. Each tray contained a puddle of experimental beta cells engineered from stem cells. They had mixed the solution with an antibody that would turn blue in the presence of insulin, and they had just added sugar. No one expected anything to happen. Minutes passed, a single tray turned blue. The young scientists rushed down the hall and told Melton, who thought it finally seemed to be working. Then he said, "Repeat it." They did, over and over. And in the years since, Melton has co-founded a biotech company to scale up production of his engineered beta cells, which a bigger biotech company, Vertex, with experience running clinical trials and applying for regulatory approvals, bought for $950 million in 2019. In a trial in 2021, Vertex gave 14 patients with severe type 1 diabetes infusions of Melton cells, dubbed VX880. Before that trial, 12 of the patients had struggled to balance their blood sugars using supplemental insulin. 90 days out, their sugars were balanced. 2 of the patients required less supplemental insulin. 10 got off it entirely. 2 patients enrolled in the trial died, though not from the treatment. Meningitis killed one, dementia the other. The scientific community is still buzzing from the publication of Vertex's results in July in the New England Journal of Medicine. They're buzzing in part because the next month the journal published the work from another lab that, combined with a stem cell therapy like VX880, could be the cure that everyone has been hoping for. Like Shapiro's islet cells, patients in the Vertex trials require immunosuppression. But in the study published in August, a team from Sana Biotechnology, a smaller company exclusively working on cell therapies, showed it may not be necessary to knock down the immune system. Scientists edited 3 genes of the islet cells from a diseased donor, eliminating the fingerprint that marked them as foreign. Then they injected them into a 43-year-old man who was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes when he was 5 years old. 6 months later, the man's immune system had not responded to the islet cells, which were still secreting insulin. Now, labs, including Vertex and Sana, are working separately on combining both technologies into a single solution. Lab-grown cells that do not require immunosuppression and reliably produce insulin. Some scientists say a therapy like that would cure type 1 diabetes. Marlon Pragnell, Vice President of Research and Science at the American Diabetes Association, says these twin breakthroughs mark a new era in medicine. I think it is literally transformational, Pragnell says. Truly transformational. It's a big deal. In the dark era before the discovery of insulin, Smith, the first patient in the Vertex trials to receive a full dose of the therapy, would have quickly died after her onset of type 1 diabetes. Now she doesn't even need insulin therapy. I look at it like such a blessing, she says. Even Melton, who pioneered this latest chapter in the treatment of the disease, struggles to express the magnitude of how far the science has come. It's almost like, I don't know, alchemy, he says. Many questions do remain. Will Sana's gene-edited islet cells continue to evade the body's immune system? Will Melton's stem cells survive longer in humans than Shapiro's ones from cadavers? Time is needed. Meanwhile, the advances in the parallel fields of stem cell therapy and gene editing are enabling breakthroughs in the treatment of other diseases as well. For instance, in an experimental clinical trial that began in 2018, a surgeon at Mass Eye and Ear in Boston transplanted a stem cell therapy into the eyes of 14 patients with badly damaged corneas. Many had no functional vision, and their eyes hurt. At checkups, 18 months later, the surgeon found that the graft had fully repaired the corneas of 10 patients, improving their vision and reducing their pain. Nature Communications published those findings in March. Then, in May, the New England Journal of Medicine published the results from scientists at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine, who gave an infant a gene-editing therapy to treat a rare, often lethal disease, and the therapy appears to be working. For now, Vertex is leading the efforts to cure type 1 diabetes. The company is in the final phase of clinical trials for its stem cell therapy and anticipates results next year, after which time it will submit for Food and Drug Administration approval. Vertex hopes to release the therapy onto the market by the end of this decade. Although the company has not yet settled on pricing, VX880 is likely to be extraordinarily expensive. The company initially listed a recent blockbuster therapy for sickle cell anemia at $2.2 million. While the market for the therapy is likely to be limited to the most severe cases, in time, it could grow. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has not been tracking the prevalence of type 1 diabetes for a very long period of time, but its latest figures set the number of Americans younger than age 20 with the disease at just over 300,000. Modeling suggests that number will climb 65% by the year 2060. Smith still gets served the kinds of advertisements on Facebook and Instagram that tell her eating cinnamon, say, will cure her type 1 diabetes. She never thought there could be an actual cure in her lifetime. To be clear, she says VX880 is not it, not yet. We don't know how long this will last, she says, but she feels healthier now on immunosuppressants than she did when her blood sugar swung wildly, a sentiment shared by many of Dr. Shapiro's patients. Smith takes three pills, three times a day, and they're tiny. It's nothing, she says. The medical community is unlikely to broadly recommend cell therapies, such as VX880, when they hit the market because of concerns about the risks of immune suppression, which is frustrating for patients who say they deserve the autonomy to decide. Binder, the former football player, learned about VX880 in his interview with National Geographic. If he was a candidate for the therapy, he'd be interested, he says, even though he balances his blood sugar well with an insulin pump and a glucose monitor. For anybody who's lived their entire life with this illness, to be free of it, Binder says, that has got to be intriguing. Now from the National Library of Medicine, a story headlined, Diabetes Research, a Perspective from the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases. The growing human and economic toll of diabetes has caused consternation worldwide, Not only is the number of people affected increasing at alarming rates, but onset of the major forms of the disease occur at even younger ages. We now know that the reach of diabetes extends far beyond the classic acute metabolic and chronic vascular complications to increased risk of an ever-increasing array of conditions, including Alzheimer's disease, cancer, liver failure, bone fractures, depression, even hearing loss. In the United States, one in three Medicare dollars is spent on care of people with diabetes, and the proportion of cardiovascular disease risk attributable to diabetes is rising. While complications of diabetes may develop slowly over a long period of time, antecedents of diabetes may lay in utero or early life. Thus, the breadth of meaningful research extends across the entire lifespan, ranging from studies of how the in utero environment alters diabetes risk to improved understanding of the special needs of older patients with diabetes. Since the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive Kidney Diseases, known as NIDDK, was established back in 1950, there have been huge progress in our ability to predict, classify, and treat diabetes and its complications, as well as to prevent or delay type 2 diabetes. Landmark NIDDK-led clinical trials demonstrate that glucose control can dramatically reduce diabetes complications, and lifestyle changes produce modest weight loss, or the drug metformin can substantially reduce development of type 2 diabetes. Were it not for all of this progress, the toll from rising rates of the major forms of diabetes would be much higher. Despite a challenging fiscal climate, the National Institutes of Health spends over $1 billion on diabetes research every year. NIDDK amounts for about two-thirds of that total, and we are determined that these resources will be invested wisely and balanced among many competing priorities. We have to address the most compelling practical questions about clinical management and prevention of diabetes and its complications, while we also work to uncover and exploit novel pathways to provide new targets and approaches to combat diabetes. Last year, a new strategic plan for diabetes research was issued under NIDDK's leadership, with input from more than 100 scientists and multiple federal agencies and components of NIH. That plan highlights progress and opportunities in 10 key areas, as well as resource and infrastructure needs. Conquering diabetes is going to require a wide range of expertise and talent, from molecular and cell biology to behavioral and social sciences. Development and empowerment of this human capital is critical to this endeavor, including facilitating multidisciplinary collaboration and the application of new technologies to diabetes research. Here, we're going to touch on highlights of our diabetes research priorities and initiatives, referring readers to the Diabetes Research Strategic Plan for a more comprehensive analysis of advances and opportunities. A well-trained and diverse scientific workforce is essential to efforts to improve outcomes for people with or at risk for diabetes. To ensure a pipeline of new, well-trained investigators in basic and clinical disciplines, NIDDK supports training grant, fellowship, and career award mechanisms to provide opportunities for investigators at all stages of the career trajectory. These are supplemented by programs targeted to specific needs, such as our medical student research program in diabetes, which allows medical students to conduct research under the direction of an established scientist at one of our 17 NIDDK-funded diabetes research centers. Supplements to research and training grants to foster recruitment of underrepresented minority scientists to diabetes research, and institutional career development programs to attract pediatric endocrinologists to careers in childhood diabetes research. It is increasingly important to build multidisciplinary research teams and train multidisciplinary researchers. We are establishing interdisciplinary training grants to promote diabetes research training for bioengineers, as well as career development programs in diabetes research for behavioral scientists. We will continue to foster the application of new expertise, for example, in computational science and bioinformatics, to diabetes research problems. To help new investigators transition to independence, we also provide a less stringent pay line for early career investigators. We also invite new investigators with NIDDK research or career development grants to participate in NIDDK workshops designed to help them succeed as independent investigators. Diabetes prevention is a major public health challenge. For type 2 diabetes, the NIDDK-led diabetes prevention program demonstrated a dramatic effect of modest weight loss or the generic drug metformin in delaying or preventing type 2 diabetes. Ongoing studies are examining the durability of this risk reduction, the cost-effectiveness of the interventions, and their impact in reducing diabetes complications. In order to facilitate translation of landmark clinical research into clinical practice and public health activities, NIDDK established a program to test practical, cost-effective approaches to deliver interventions proven efficacious in clinical trials for effectiveness in both community and practice settings. One such NIDDK-supported study of a lifestyle change intervention delivered by YMCA fitness trainers already is being rolled out nationwide by the YMCA with coverage from insurers such as the United Health Group. In another promising approach, diabetes educators trained selected patients with well-controlled diabetes to serve as community health workers, delivering a lifestyle intervention based on the DPP to community members with prediabetes. This NIDDK-funded research provides a basis for a new congressionally established National Diabetes Prevention Program at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to foster delivery of evidence-based lifestyle change programs for people who may be at high risk for type 2 diabetes. Given the sustained effort required to achieve and maintain lifestyle change, much additional research is needed to improve, disseminate, and evaluate type 2 diabetes prevention programs in the United States. Approaches are also needed to reduce the development of risk factors for diabetes. Of particular importance are studies to reduce environmental exposures during pregnancy or childhood that may increase diabetes and obesity risk. The incidence of type 1 diabetes is rising worldwide, and the disease is occurring at younger ages, suggesting an environmental trigger is responsible. Bold new programs aimed at preventing type 1 diabetes have been undertaken with support from the Special Statutory Funding Program for Type 1 Diabetes Research, which provides $150 million per year through 2013 for type 1 diabetes research. These special funds are in addition to the regular NIH appropriation. One program established under the program, the Environmental Determinants of Diabetes in the Young, codenamed TEDDY, has screened nearly 500,000 neonates to establish a cohort of over 8,000 who are at high genetic risk for type 1 diabetes. Participants will be followed from birth through the age of 15 to identify dietary, infectious, microbiome, or other environmental triggers of autoimmunity, and type 1 diabetes, and also to study the interaction between environmental factors and specific genetic variations associated with disease risk. Identification of an infectious agent or a dietary factor that triggers or protects against the disease would have immense implications for prevention through the development of a vaccine or dietary change. Also, with special program support, the Type 1 Diabetes Trial Net is identifying individuals recently diagnosed with Type 1 diabetes or at high risk of developing it, and testing interventions to prevent diabetes or slow its progression. Selective immune modulation has been shown to preserve insulin secretion in newly diagnosed patients, and TrialNet is exploring the use of one such agent, teplizumab, to prevent type 1 diabetes in individuals at very high short-term risk of type 1 diabetes. In the future, combination therapies aimed at modulating multiple steps of the toxic immune response and restoring immunoregulation may produce a clinically significant delay in onset and ultimately the prevention of type 1 diabetes. While information on how to prevent and treat type 2 diabetes has grown rapidly, adequate data from rigorous clinical trials are not available to inform many routine decisions on care for patients. Current guidelines are moving away from a one-size-fits-all type of approach to incorporate factors such as diabetes duration and the presence of complications or other comorbidities. However, we lack information to individualize therapy based on demographic, physiologic, or genetic variation. Improved understanding of the genetic, physiologic, and environmental factors that underlie diabetes mellitus are necessary for more individualized diabetes treatment. A number of drugs are approved for the treatment of type 2 diabetes based largely on relatively short-term efficacy in glycemic reduction. However, it's not known whether particular drugs or drug combinations will have more durable effects in the maintenance of glucose control. NIDDK is supporting a large comparative effectiveness trial to inform the choice of second agent when metformin alone is inadequate for glycemic control. This multi-center randomized trial will provide information on health benefits as well as cost-effectiveness of widely used treatments. Small studies suggest it may be possible to preserve cell function during prediabetes and early in the course of type 2 diabetes. Major questions include the optimal timing of interventions, whether specific treatments have maximum benefit at different stages of the disease, and what patient characteristics influence the choice of initial therapy for each individual. A newly formed consortium will be examining the approaches to the initial treatment of type 2 diabetes that may reverse or slow the decline in certain cell function over time. While major trials have established the importance of blood pressure and lipid control in reducing cardiovascular disease in type 2 diabetes, much less is known about how cardiovascular risk factors should be managed in type 1 diabetes, when blood pressure and lipid lowering should begin and optimal therapeutic targets remain to be established. Although type 1 diabetes increases the risk of cardiovascular disease as much as tenfold compared to an age-matched population, testing practical approaches to mitigate this risk is challenging due to the low incidence of cardiovascular disease in the younger type 1 diabetes population. Such trials may require the development of the validated biomarkers that we will discuss below. Self-management training and promotion of effective self-care behaviors are vital to improving outcomes. The choices that patients make every day about diet, physical activity, adherence to medications, self-monitoring, foot and dental care, and medical follow-up for early detection of complications are critical for improving diabetes outcomes. Research has established effective counseling and education strategies, including motivational interviewing, patient empowerment, and social and peer support. But research is needed to expand the reach of such approaches to more patients and providers. NIDDK encourages research studying approaches such as group visits, telemedicine, and social media that may extend the impact of the limited workforce skilled in the provision of this care. Diabetes spares no age, sex, racial, or ethnic group, yet each such group faces special challenges. Intensive glycemic control in youth may afford lifelong protection from complications, yet infancy and adolescence pose unique challenges in attaining such control. Treatment priorities and optimal glycemic, blood pressure, and cholesterol targets to prevent complications and maintain quality of life may differ for older adults or those with limited life expectancy. The Eunice Kennedy Shriver National Institute of Child Health and Human Development led hyperglycemia and adverse pregnancy outcome study did show that perinatal harm to mother and offspring occurs in pregnancy at lower levels of glycemia than had previously been appreciated. To identify gestational glycemic thresholds for longer-term effects on offspring and the risk of type 2 diabetes in mothers, NIDDK will support a follow-up study of this important cohort. NIDDK has also recently launched a study to explore approaches for the prevention of gestational diabetes mellitus. It also remains to be established what treatments during pregnancy mitigate perinatal and or long-term complications of gestational diabetes mellitus. Biological and environmental risk factors that contribute to underlying racial and ethnic disparities are currently poorly understood. The alarming emergence of type 2 diabetes in young people overwhelmingly occurs in the minority population. Ominous data on poor risk factor control portends very poor outcomes for this vulnerable population. To address this threat, NIDDK recently completed a major multi-center trial comparing three approaches to the treatment of type 2 diabetes in youth and a trial conducted in schools serving poor and minority children to prevent the development of risk factors for type 2 diabetes. As better therapies for HIV infection, organ transplantation, cystic fibrosis, and other conditions improve survival, diabetes has emerged as an increasingly important complication. Critical questions must be addressed about optimal strategies to prevent and treat diabetes. For example, early diabetes diagnosis and treatment helped improve survival in people with cystic fibrosis-related diabetes. An NIDDK-funded trial showed that chronic weight loss can be reversed with the institution of insulin therapy, but not with repaglinide early in the course of CFRD before fasting hyperglycemia develops. A current initiative will support research to understand the pathogenesis of CFRD, which affects half of adults with cystic fibrosis. NIDDK will also encourage research on treatment and prevention of diabetes in patients with HIV. Exceptional contributions to understanding diabetes in special populations have emerged from NIDDK's intramural research program. Spanning decades and generations, longitudinal studies of Pima Indians have uncovered physiologic, environmental, and genetic determinants of diabetes in the U.S. population with highest rates of type 2 diabetes. These studies have foreshadowed findings in the broader population, such as the contribution of intrauterine factors to childhood obesity and type 2 diabetes, and the prognosis for these youth. Collaborations between intramural and extramural researchers studying individuals with severe insulin resistance and lipodystrophy have yielded important physiological information and the emergence of leptin replacement therapy for lipodystrophy. Population health data are essential to inform prevention strategies for diabetes and its complications. To identify trends in the development of diabetes and diabetes complications in the general population and in subpopulations, as well as to measure gaps in the translation of proven therapies into clinical practice. NIDDK has partnered with the Centers for Disease Control to support the Search for Diabetes in Youth study, a multi-center study that identifies cases of diabetes in people under 20 years of age in five geographically dispersed populations that encompass the ethnic diversity of the United States. Search has found that one out of every 523 persons under the age of 20 has diabetes, and 15,000 children are diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, and 3,700 are diagnosed with type 2 diabetes annually. Search also provides data on trends in incidence and risk factor control in the pediatric diabetes population. So that information on diabetes can be obtained at lower cost than if an independent study were initiated, NIDDK provides substantial support for the diabetes components of major CDC-led efforts, including the National Health and Nutrition Evaluation Survey and the National Health Information Survey. Partners with other components of NIH to enhance diabetes measures in ongoing studies, and offers support for investigator-initiated ancillary studies that are focused on diabetes. Of particular importance are collaborations with the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute to address the increasing proportion of cardiovascular disease attributable to diabetes and issues such as balancing the cardiometabolic risks and benefits associated with statin use. Skipping ahead here to one other section. Because knowledge of genetic risk factors has the potential for disease prediction, patient stratification and insights into pathogenesis that can generate new approaches to prevention and treatment, NIDDK has expended considerable resources to apply state-of-the-art molecular and computational science to identify diabetes risk genes. Perhaps the most profound impact of these genetic discoveries has been in children with neonatal diabetes, who were often wrongly diagnosed with type 1 diabetes and treated with insulin. Now, children with mutations in certain genes that regulate insulin secretion are treated more safely and effectively with sulfonylurea drugs rather than insulin genetic testing for type 1 diabetes risk has made possible, the TEDDY study and trial nut prevention studies described previously. The NIDDK-led International Type 1 Diabetes Genetics Consortium helped increase the number of identified risk genes and gene regions from 3 just a decade ago to more than 50 today. The challenge now? Let's understand how this variation contributes to disease pathogenesis, opening up new therapeutic targets. We're encouraged by the DPP finding that relative risk reduction with lifestyle change was as great in those carrying the high-risk mutation as in other participants, despite higher rates of progression to diabetes. DPP also provided important pharmacogenetic data that showed participants with a specific KCNJI1 variant, or alterations in metformin transport genes, were less protected by metformin. These observations offer the possibility of individualizing therapy based on genotype. That's diabetes news for today. A lot of it is very scientific, but so much promise in diabetes care and treatment is on the horizon. I'm Scott. Enjoy your day.
This is your Better Business Bureau with our tip of the week. When your phone rings these days, you can't always believe caller ID. Technology makes it easy for scammers to fake caller ID information. If someone calls out of the blue, asking for money or personal information, hang up. If you think the caller might be telling the truth, call back to a number you know is genuine. It's best to not answer calls from unknown numbers. If you do answer the phone and the caller asks you to hit a button to stop getting the calls, you should just hang up. Scammers often use this trick to identify potential targets. Never give out personal information such as account numbers, social security numbers, mother's maiden name, passwords, or other identifying information in response to unexpected calls. Talk to your phone company about call blocking tools that may be available and check into apps that you can download to your mobile device. Remember to call BBB if you suspect a scam or want to report a scam, even if you don't lose money. Your scam report will help prevent additional victims. Our toll-free number is 1-866-566-9222.
Welcome to Everyday Poems for Everyday, sponsored by Audio Journal. Our poem today is Watching My Dog Sleep by Kate Tempest. Murphy is dreaming. His muscles are twitching. His ears are alive. His paws scrape the air. He's dreaming of yesterday. Stones thrown into waves. The heartbreak of chasing. What's no longer there? You've been listening to Everyday Poems for Everyday, sponsored by Audio Journal, and read by me, Nikki Wichelow. Thanks for listening, and may your life be filled with poetic wonder.